All right, welcome everybody to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we've been having a great time over the past year or so reading. It's the longest I ever took to read a book in my whole life. Reading the book by Gary Renard, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, The History of Mighty Companions, and we're just about to the end, surprisingly enough, after a year of reading. But, you know, that's okay. And I'm just wondering, let's see, oh gosh, all of a sudden I'm looking at a whole nother book. So let me go to my Kindle and go back. Not sure. Oh, I know why. I was looking at another book. But my daughter buys books, and I don't know. I come on here, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, look at all these new books on here. But this is the one we're in now. All right. So how was your Thanksgiving, Bruce?
Oh, really nice. Really nice. I had a nice gathering up the hill with some neighbors who are dear friends. And, yeah, just really, really pleasant. Yeah.
Isn't that sweet? Your new neighborhood, and you've got, I mean, new neighborhood, but you've got friends to have Thanksgiving with.
Well, actually, they're ones that we sort of followed here to the Oregon coast. We some friends of ours we've known for about 15 years or so in Southern Oregon moved here, I think, about 8 years ago now, and they built a house up the hill from us, and make a short story slightly longer. A couple of years ago, we were visiting some mutual friends in Portland, and they were there, and they said, hey, we'll drive you down to Yahats and show you this house that's for sale if you're interested, and you might like it. And you know, we were thinking, well, maybe in a year or two or three, we'll move back to the West Coast somewhere. You know, weren't sure where. And we drove down here, and I said, gee, this is kind of nice. And here we are. that's the short version.
Well, that's perfect. I love that. So, you know, I mean, that's wonderful that you have people there, and it is like your family.
Yeah.
You know, when we grow up, we are able to make a new family who is, I mean, we still love our old family, but now we have other people that we know there are soul mates, really. You know, everyone that you meet in this world that you become close to and brotherly with becomes your soulmate. It's not just one-to-one-to-one, because there are really, you know, there is really only one of us. So find more brothers who we can relate to as family, it doesn't completely change or solve the whole problem, but it definitely shifts our way of seeing, so that we can allow more love in our lives. I believe that families need to be, love each other. And, you know, sometimes...
what a concept.
That sounds kind of crazy to say it that way. But, you know, there's a lot of times that you meet people who you've never had any relationship to that you love more than the family of your birth. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, when I'm saying family, you're my family. I love you.
Absolutely.
So
likewise.
To me, you know, I trust you with anything. You know, Sandy and I went out to the ACIM conference in San Francisco and met up with Carrie, who's here in the room, and it's his birthday today, so it's interesting. Anyway, we met up with Carrie, and we had communicated before, he and I, and he said he would come down and take us because he didn't live in San Francisco, but he would come to San Francisco, and he would pick us up, and he would take us places and show us things, and I was so happy, you know, that, you know, oh my gosh, you know, what a gift. And he wasn't even coming to the conference. He didn't even have tickets to the conference, but he was just going to come down and hang out with us just to be with us, just to nice. Because we're family. Mm-hmm. And he did do that. And Sandy, who is, you know, kind of family, she says, well, how do you know this guy? You know, what do you know about him? You know, we're going to just get into a van with a stranger and go running around San Francisco. You know, why? what if he's, you know, a crazy serial killer or something? I'm like, I do know this guy. I've never met this person in person. But I know everything about, I know his heart. I know what he cherishes. You know, I know he's just like me. You know, of course he's safe. And, it didn't take her very long, did it, Carrie, to cotton to you. But, you know, I just realized how in the world we're so suspicious of, you know, who we don't know and so afraid that they are likely or capable of hurting us, but they're our family. So the only reason that I don't know how innocent you are is because I don't know you. I just know a character. And when I recognize you, who you are, I see your perfect innocence. And Carrie says about 10 seconds. Yeah, it's so you know, that's really how I think Jesus is advocating that we look at the world and at people. Not that my nuclear family, my spouse, my children, not that that's my family, but that we're all a brotherhood. We're all the same thing. And so, you know, the more we expand that and get out of that nuclear family thinking and into, that goes to, you know, my family of origin, that goes to my city, that goes to my state, that goes to my country, that goes to, you know, my race, my color, my gender, all these little specialities that we segregate ourselves out into and say, anything that's not this is not my family. I mean, I don't mean to get on a big old rag about this, but it just seems to me that unless we're able to open up to everyone in the entire sonship, our entire brotherhood, with the same, maybe not the same love we give our families, because that might not be very helpful either. But
to me, Lynn, if I can.
Go ahead.
Just an idea. The challenge is to remember that on the level of behavior, on the level of form, it's perfectly appropriate to, you know, give very specific types of attention and care and affection and so forth to very specific people in our lives. But in the level of the mind, what A Course in Miracles suggests is that we return to the place where we never left in our minds that knows that we're all the same in truth and the eternal unchanging essence of what we really are. Essence is within every seeming individual, every seeming, whether plant, animal, mineral, vegetable, human, you know, extraterrestrial, whether it's, you know, inanimate. So what we think of as an animate or inanimate object or, you know, the cosmos or down to quarks and quasars, you know, back up to quasars. It doesn't really matter. It's all the same essence, no matter what seeming aspects or parts of it we are focusing on, because the divisions are only in our mind. And I think that's where, you know, the all one family is really a crucial a concept. And that's also a really effective way to look at what our next classroom is if there's something that we see as different from ourselves. And again, not on level of form, because obviously the differences are, you know, how we navigate through the world of form. And you know, we're taught to refine and define differences to the nth degree, you know, and without that, we wouldn't have, you know, the world or any specific things in the world. But we can use those as a mechanism to get back to the mind and to see where we're making grievances real, where we're making victimhood real, where we're making you know, anything that separates us in terms of how we feel about each other and ourselves as separate things, that's the royal road back to our unconscious. And that's, you know, how we can use everything that appears to be an annoyance or an irritation or an upset of any kind to get back to the mind. And that's a classroom that we are well advised to not ignore.
Exactly. And, you know, that's why these lessons, you know, if you do the lesson every day, and I know people say, oh, Jesus only says do it once. But, you know, every time I read the lesson, I say, did I do this before?
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that I know now? Is this what my experience now? And today's lesson is especially one of those that, you know, it used to really get to me when I would read it because it seems so confusing. You know, let me take the second to be the first and second place to be the first. And, you know, I thought, you know, it doesn't even make sense to me. But now it makes perfect sense that, you know, let my will, my perception, let go of it and listen to God.
Yeah. It also ties in beautifully to what Ken Wapnick has said on many occasions, is to make it about the other person, which is to say if we can make it about the relationship, because the relationship has to include the welfare of every other seeming other in order to be effective. And the only way we're going to ever get that information is to be informed by the Holy Spirit's vision and to allow and ask for, you know, to seek for our blocks to that vision. And, you know, whenever we feel any kind of tension or animosity or anxiety or lack or any of that stuff, it's just like, okay, I must have chosen wrongly because I'm not at peace. And so that's when we need to choose, the fact that we're offspring of the Creator, not the prime, you know, we're not the first cause. We are always an effect, and that's why I think those workbook lessons are juxtaposed, because, you know, we recognize that we're just basically, you know, as Gary says in one of his books here, it might be this one again, you know, Jesus wasn't the ultimate leader, he was the ultimate follower. And the ultimate follower being the ability, you know, an example of the ability to listen to the Holy Spirit consistently to where that's the only thing. And I was listening to one of the many wonderful presentations. I think this might have been Michael Dawson, who has an Australian Course in Miracles Center. Great talk that he gave on the Awakening to Love conference that's wrapping up in the next couple of days. If you happen to be listening Wednesday or Thursday, you might have caught the recording I did with Armin Rott, and we had a lot of fun. But there's over 100 different presentations, and if you haven't checked it out, you still have a couple days to listen to the last, you know, 2 or 3 days worth, and then after that you can purchase the whole conference for a very nominal amount. I put a link to it on aciandblog.com if you're interested. It's like, I think they have a suggested, quick aside, a suggested donation of, I think the 33 is the minimum, and 100 is kind of a sliding scale, the maximum, with, you know, another one in the middle. But, you know, if you think of how much it costs to fly across the country or across the world to a international conference with 100 different speakers and here are 200 hours worth of video, I mean, it's like just astonishing how great a deal that is.
It is an amazing deal.
And yeah, yeah.
I'm probably going to buy that just to have the recordings. I can play them here.
Me too. Yeah, and so for $33, it is, you know, on the low end of the sliding scale, that's a very, I mean, these folks are really, 8 or 9 folks in mostly Europe have put together this conference, and there's course material in English, a whole lot, of course, of those, and then quite a few in Spanish, and a number in German, and even some in Portuguese. And so, they've done just a wonderful job. And some of the, there's two different sessions that were the folks from the Foundation for Inner Peace that I watched very intently a couple times, because I can watch the replays, and that had Judy Scutch Whitson and Dr. Bob Rosenthal and Judy's daughter, Tamara Morgan. And they had some wonderful things to share. So anyway, enough of that. You, again, you can go to ACIMblog.com and click on the link in the upper segment there, and then there's a link to it there. And I appreciate using those links because I get a little affiliate income if people subscribe there, so, and that helps me do my labors of love stuff, which is a whole bunch of core stuff every week. So.
Outstanding. Anyway. And you know, I know you do a lot of things like that and get like little bits and pieces of income from some of the things that the projects that you promote, which is really good. But it makes me think of, remember that movie The Jerk, where he invented the thing to push your glasses up?
OptiGrab.
Yeah, and then made people go cross-eyed, and so they all sued him, and so he had to send all checks for like, was a check for a dollar or one?
Well, I don't recall that part of it exactly.
Tiny little bit. He had to sit and write out checks to every single one of those people for like a dollar. Because of the lawsuit, but that, I think about that, you know, anytime anybody has little incremental incomes coming in. You know, you get a check for a dollar today, or you get.
Well, anyway, I just wanted to let people know that if they haven't heard, you know, those conference sessions, there's still, you know, a day or two left to catch those. And there's just some really good ones. I think the tomorrow Marianne Williamson there's a recorded session with her, and they start off with Gary and Cindy. So, and they've, you know, covered quite a large spectrum. I'm going to send a few other recommendations, including you, Lynn, and a bunch of folks in the Denver area that I think are wonderful teachers, and you know, a handful of others that I think would be good additions when they do it again. But that, considering how they started out with, they did a tremendous job, I think. And by the way, the Miracle Show Conference, which is a different online virtual conference, we've just been talking this past week. We've been also so busy with the January timeframe that we've postponed originally is now kind of looking unlikely. So it's probably going to be February or March before we get that going. But stay tuned for that too. So that'll be fun too. Smaller in terms of the scope, but the quality will be outstanding. So.
Yeah, and you know, that's always great. That Miracle Share is always just a wonderful conference as well. So
online,
and you don't have to fly anywhere or go anywhere or do anything.
Same deal. Yeah, exactly.
Just perfect. So.
Yep.
All right. Well,
so
let's
meanwhile,
begin. I think we're like almost done, and I think we were going to go back a little bit, and hopefully you marked.
I did.
Okay.
You want me to start reading? And
you can, yeah, why don't you go ahead?
I'm at the bottom of 199, which I'm just going to go back like a paragraph or two. Let's see. I'll start with where Artin says, and you know the course well enough to give him an answer. And this is talking, in backing up to that is somebody, let me back up one more paragraph. Gary says, yeah, that's true. You go to China and you get the same kinds of questions you do anyplace else. The guy raises his hand and he wants to know how he can get along with his mother-in-law or anybody else, right? And Arden says, and you know the course well enough to give him an answer. Gary, the Holy Spirit knows the course well enough to give him an answer. Speaking of the Holy Spirit, I remember the story of how Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov of the Soviet Union saved the world from nuclear annihilation back in 83, and I'm glad he's gotten some recognition for that, since you told me about him back in the 90s. It makes me wonder. You said he listened to the Holy Spirit to make his decision not to launch the nuclear missiles. Does the Holy Spirit often intervene in world situations? And I'm going to do a quick aside on that comment and suggest that every time we forgive instead of condemn, we're stopping our nuclear arsenal in the mind. So this isn't just some hypothetical thing here. We're stopping our world from being annihilated each time we choose the peace of forgiveness that leads to tremendous gratitude ultimately. But that graceful choice is really when we let anyone or anything off the hook that seems to be interfering with our peace, that we've put in the way as our projection, and we can recognize, like, well, this is something I put in the way. I just have to get it out of the way, you know. I'm going to my one of my favorite Robin Williams skits where he says we put shit in the way. The golfing one. Anyway, but okay, I'll go on. Arden says, what the Holy Spirit does is speak to everyone through the right part of the mind. Of course, the person has to be willing to listen. Adolf Hitler's mind was 99% influenced by the ego, and the Holy Spirit was not listened to by him. There was no willingness. Everybody has at least 1% spirit, even Chairman Mao, who killed way more people than Hitler. That's because you can't destroy the truth, you can only cover it over. On the other hand, you have someone like Gandhi, whose mind was 99% influenced by spirit, and he was more than willing to listen. Because of duality, it stands to reason that a lot of people are in the 50-50 range. They have a chance, but they have to make the decision to listen. If they listen, they become more like Gandhi. That's just an example, of course. You don't have to influence world events the way Gandhi did, but if you feel guided to do so by spirit, then go for it. The important thing is that the mind is moving in the right direction. It's becoming more peaceful, and peace is the condition of the kingdom. You want to go on from there?
Sure. So this whole idea of the Holy Spirit, you know, doesn't really change the direction of anything or do anything, because that direction is already part of the illusion. Mm-hmm. So every direction is part of the illusion. It's just, you know, us choosing which one to go on. It's still, you know, all the other options are still there of complete annihilation or complete love. So it's wonderful that you know, if Hitler would have been listening, or you know, I just read a story this morning about a young man who was a missionary, and he decided for some reason that these natives who are virtually untouched, I guess, apparently have been approached by society and civilization, and they just said, "No way, we're not interested," which is, you know, smart on their part. But, you know, this young man, missionary.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, I just remind me, since we were talking about Gandhi, I think one of my favorite quotes of his is, he was once asked what he thought of Western civilization. His response was, he thought it would be a good idea.
It would be a good idea. Yes, exactly. So these guys are in the same boat, right? But then, you know, this young man who, because of his religious upbringing, his belief in Jesus, his idea of, you know, what's best and what's right and wrong, and maybe his fear that these poor natives were going to go to hell if they didn't know about Jesus, he decided that he would go over there and tell them about Jesus, even though it was illegal and there was completely the government, I think it was India, it's an island off of India, and the government of India had said no one can go there, and yet he decided to bribe some poor fishermen to take him there, which they did, and then he went there, and guess what? You know, the guys killed him. They're like, hey, we said no, we don't want you, you know, killed him dead, and then buried him on the beach. So, you know, I mean, I'm not laughing about this poor guy and his silly superstition in his life. It just is so much of how can I tell you what is the right way to be? Why is it my business? And yet, this is you know what all the struggle in the world is about. I'm right and you're wrong. And so
did they bury him in the missionary position?
I don't know.
I couldn't resist.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, it's pretty crazy because, you know, now there's a big, you know, obviously big to-do about it in the world. And, you know, this poor missionary, and I'm like, no, you know, they said, no, we don't want your Jesus, you know, get out of here. And, you know, I don't blame them at all. I mean, obviously I don't condone murder, but, you know, I also don't condone forcing your beliefs on people who are, it's always been so helpful to all the natives everywhere we've gone. I don't know why we wouldn't keep doing it.
she said, tongue firmly planted in cheek, right?
Yes, tongue firmly in cheek, yes. Okay, so Persa says, Over the eons, people have been fascinated with the struggle between good and evil, between what they perceived as God and the devil. Well, this is one of the things that the Course says about the devil. The mind can make the belief in separation very real and very fearful, and this belief is the devil. It is powerful, active, destructive, and clearly in opposition to God, because it literally denies his fatherhood. Now, it's the authority problem, right? Mm-hmm. Look at your life and see what the devil has done, but realize that this making will surely dissolve in the light of truth because its foundation is a lie. So, you know, that's, of course, miracles, Jesus saying, once you start shining the truth on this, you'll notice that it isn't really true. It doesn't really, nothing is really happening here.
Right. There's no, I think it's important to point out too, there's no condemnation in that recognition. It's just basically saying, you know, I love how Ken Wapnick, you know, over and over again says it's not evil, sinful, or wicked. It's just silly. I mean, it's like, why would you want to subject yourself and everyone that your mind reaches, which is everyone, to that silliness? And another thing that comes to mind is there's a Aramaic scholar named Neil Douglas Klotz, and I remembered his name just because he was on a radio show years ago, and he said something that really stuck with me, and that is the Aramaic word for evil, you know, which is, what is that, 80% of the word devil, I guess you could say, is actually unripe. That was what it would really, you know, kind of the best English word to translate it into is unripe. And I thought, well, that really is a revelatory idea, because it means that condemnation is never warranted. Because if you think of, you know, I go out and I'll pick blackberries in our neighborhood here in August, but if I were to pick them in May or June even, you know, they're still green or red and they're awful. I mean, you know, why would you want to eat that? Nope, you'd spit it out immediately. And the same thing is true with our awareness when we aren't completely, as Barton and Peirce have been saying, when we're in the low percentage points, you don't condemn a berry for not being ripe because you picked it too early. In the same way, you know, we need to look with compassion at the Hitlers and the Chairman Mao's and the you know, the politicians that we love to hate, and realize, you know, they're suffering just as much. Their expression of insanity is a call for love seen properly.
Yes.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that we don't do the appropriate thing and you know, eagerly await the outcome of the Mueller investigation, for example, and things like that. But it just means we don't make a big deal out of anything that happens or doesn't happen in the world when we listen to the Holy Spirit and we go get up toward that 99% that Gary's teachers are talking about here, and just, you know, when we're willing to listen. And I think the other thing that struck me in the conversation I listened to earlier this morning about from the gentleman from Australia talking about, you know, how, you know, Jesus' last lesson was to listen completely to the Holy Spirit. You know, it was basically to have nothing but the Holy Spirit's guidance as for everything.
Exactly.
And I think that's why we're in so much resistance, because we think that, you know, our contribution is, you know, is our understanding is a valuable contribution to the truth and makes it what it is, you know, as the Course humorously points out, you know.
It's like, yes, it's so funny.
No, not really.
Yeah. That is hilarious. And yes, and that is what Jesus says in A Course in Miracles. He says, and my final lesson, and it took great willingness and effort, was to hear only one voice.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're unripe. You know, we're,
yeah. Which is another way of saying we're all kind of schizophrenic by choice, because we want to have a horrible cake and eat it too. but the real cake is complete oneness, and we thought we threw that away. So we're eating this bitter duality cake. And wondering why we still keep having to come back and revisit, you know, our decision in the mind. Well, duh.
I know. It just seems
we chose. an unripe choice, and there's nothing wrong. It's just silly, right?
And if you look at history, which is pretty amazing, when you start, like my daughter is a, you know, she studies American history. That's her uh-huh. big deal. She just loves American history and Chinese history too. She's really into China, but you know, she's telling me stories of, you know, where at one point. A vice president of the United States who got angry because of something that happened in the Congress or something, went and tried to start his own country, tried to take over part of, like, Louisiana and start his own country. And he was a vice president, and they impeached him. You know, I mean,
crazy. I think I might have seen a documentary about that somewhere not too long ago.
This is like the craziest things. I mean, yeah. Really, honestly, our history is full of insanity.
And, oh, yeah.
And we think, oh, this is the worst thing that could ever happen. No, this happened before over and over and over.
Oh, yeah. Well, that authority problem you mentioned earlier is another example of that, in addition to one in the South. A place where I used to live in Northern California, they had a place called Rough and Ready that tried to secede from the Union back around the Civil War era. And I think probably to this day still have an annual Secession Days parade and festivities. But it's kind of a symbol of, you know, I'll do it on my own, that John Wayne, you know, mindset of like, oh, I can do it myself. You know, I'll be better off. You know, a prodigal, you know, but that's, you know, the little kid with a knapsack over its shoulder on a stick and, you know, running away from home and, you know, we always come back because we know we're not going to be able to survive. But that's really at the heart of what A Course in Miracles is about is, you know, resign now as your own teacher because you were badly taught. And if we, you know, listen to our own teaching, we're going to continue to be less than perfectly happy. So, you know,
exactly. but authority problem.
Yeah, but give yourself a lot of time you need, you know, and that's why, you know, you were talking about earlier that, you know, the importance of free will and letting people reach that decision in their own way and their own time is so important, isn't it?
It is so important, and it's also essential to me to, you know, not to think that I'm so far above them as to, you know, be able to look back and say, oh, come on, you guys, hurry up. I'm not. You know, it's Abdu'l-Bahá, who is one of the prophets of the Baha'i faith, he gave this analogy. He says, it's like, you know, everybody on the earth is, you know, still as far away from the sun, even if they're standing on top of Mount Everest. From the sun.
Yeah, as a first approximation, this is completely true. Yeah.
So you know, we're all equally wrong in believing or expecting that what we think should be should be, and you know, that whole idea of being unripe. It made me think about the story, which I, you know, now do not believe in any way at all, from the Gospels, but I know that it must have a meaning. That Jesus and his followers were walking down the road and he was hungry and he saw a fig tree, and the fig tree either didn't have figs on it or the figs on it were not ripe. And he condemned that tree and he, you know, basically with his will just caused it to burst into flame or whatever, you know, kill the tree because it wasn't, giving him some fruit when he was hungry. That is, I think, you know, there must be another reason, another meaning to that, because that sounds like he's condemning them for being unripe. And, you know, Jesus would not do that for under any circumstance, because he knows we're all listening to all those other voices. So so I'm going to continue reading.
Okay.
Because this goes right into it. Mm-hmm. So the devil is really separation and the mind's belief in it. After all, what is war but separation? What is projection, the blaming of people, inquisitions, torture, and punishment, but separation? What is all violence and terrorism? How can you have judgment in all its tragedy without separation? The devil may be blamed, but the belief in the seeming separation from God and the endless symbols that go along with it will always be the cause.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to read that sentence again. The devil may be blamed, but the belief in the seeming separation from God and the endless symbols that go along with it will always be the cause. All the sorrows of your life are caused by some form of judgment, which makes the belief in separation real, but you have it within yourself to end all suffering with forgiveness and dissolve the ego thought system. The devil disappears along with it, for they are one and the same.
Indeed. So we can't use the Flip Wilson excuse, the devil made me do it, because it's the decision maker is always within everyone's mind. And, you know, the trick, I think, is when we find ourselves choosing against kindness, choosing against sameness, choosing against inclusion, to forgive ourselves as quickly as we can and not judge ourselves further by making a big deal out of an unripe choice, you know, and just say, okay, I was afraid of love. If everyone here is in this world is in this remedial classroom where we're learning to not honor and foster that, you know, unfounded fear. And I got afraid because I chose to be afraid, and that's okay because I'm already home dreaming of exile, and eventually I will get into that 99% bracket, and you know, like Gandhi, and then I'll be ready to go home and let God take the final step, you know, as the course
says. Exactly.
But in the meantime, we have plenty of work to do, and not to skip over steps and not to do the spiritual bypass, as it's called.
Exactly. And again, thank you for bringing that up, because honestly, you know, how tempted I am to do the spiritual bypass and to, you know, right now I just went to the doctor yesterday and I have pneumonia. And so to go into the, I am not a body, I am free, I'm still as God created me, or sickness is a defense against the truth, or, you know, any kind of spiritual bypass to get me out of being responsible for this sickness of the body is really, it's not helpful, because I have to look at what is the reason. And I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday, the same kind of thing, someone who has chronic illness. And, you know, I had to say, you know, to her the same thing. And we both just laughed about this. You know, obviously we don't have this condition unless we want this condition.
Sure.
And how much do we, what does it bring to me? What is the gift that I get from being sick? You know, and I was looking at it, you know, all the reason I want to be sick, because Jesus says to us, you can't be well until you understand the reason why you want to be sick. And so, you know, what are the perks that come from it? You know, a feeling of being right and being a martyr and whatever it is, you know, it's something probably that came up when I was a kid, because when I would get sick, then, you know, people would pay attention to me. And I bet I'm not alone in that. But, you know, look at, you know, what's the reason for this? And then, you know, understand why it is that you really want it. And, you know, there's no reason to be sick if you understand why. So,
right, but in the meantime, we, like you say, you know, when you have something like pneumonia, you go to the doctor, do what you feel, and, you know, appropriate to do that fits with your belief system and fits with, you know, what is comfortable for you, and allow yourself to do, you know, what of course we call magic. But hey, breathing is magic. Drinking water is magic. Sleep is magic. Anything that we do in the world that maintains our belief in the world is magic. So condemning yourself for magic is exceptionally silly. And, you know, as the Course points out early in the text, you know, to deny one's physical, you know, experience is a particularly unworthy form of denial. I'm paraphrasing that, of course, but basically say, you know, and I think Ken Wapnick, you know, echoes this beautifully when he talks about, you know, Freud's, I know I've mentioned this more than a few times, but it's, I think it bears repeating, is that, you know, the royal road to the unconscious is looking without condemnation at the dream. And of course, as all our time is spent in dreaming. So if we can just look at our interpretations of space and time in the world and all the things in it, including our bodies, without condemnation, just say, wow, yeah, I need to be gentle and I need to be kind. Do the things that feel appropriate. And then eventually the pneumonia will be old ammonia and it'll drop away, right?
So. That's right. And then we'll use the ammonia, which carries to wake us up.
There you go.
Or to clean the windows.
Yeah, that's right.
Which ammonia actually is a byproduct of urine. And not to change the subject or anything, but, you know, here it is. This is the thing that you think is, I mean, we don't get our ammonia from urine, but it does happen. Because the nitrates in the urine concentrate as it evaporates, and you get ammonia. So, you know, even the thing that we use gets a nasty thing that has to be flushed away can actually be used to wash my windows. So
in other words, the Holy Spirit takes our pissiness and turns it into a blessing, huh?
I'm laughing and coughing, so I had to
Okay.
All right, you read.
Okay, all right. So, Arden goes on to say, everything changes with the Holy Spirit. If you give the endeavors of your life to the Holy Spirit, that's a spiritual gift. You mentioned the movie with Matt Damon. Even though he didn't say it verbally, it was clear that in the movie, his psychic gift was eventually transformed into a tool that was used by the Holy Spirit for his purposes instead of for the ego's purposes of separation. That idea is in beautiful harmony with what the Course says about people who have such a gift. And then there's a fairly long paragraph here. Any ability that anyone develops has the potentiality for good. To this, there is no exception. And the more unusual and unexpected the power, the greater its potential usefulness. Salvation has need of all abilities. For what the world would destroy, the Holy Spirit would restore. Quote, psychic, unquote, abilities have been used to call upon the devil, which merely means to strengthen the ego. Yet here is also a great channel of hope and healing in the Holy Spirit's service. Those who have developed, quote, psychic, unquote, powers have simply let some of the limitations they laid upon their minds be lifted. It can be but further limitations they lay upon themselves if they utilize their increased freedom for greater imprisonment. The Holy Spirit needs these gifts, and those who offer them to him alone go with Christ's gratitude upon their hearts and his holy sight not far behind. And now Persa comments, remember, the Holy Spirit knows your value was established by God, not the world. In this, all are equal. The next time you're tempted to get down on yourself, feel unworthy, or get discouraged, remember us, remember Jay, remember the Holy Spirit, and remember God. Once you get up to the level of Spirit, we are all the Holy Spirit, for we are truth. You can't win with the lies of the ego, but you can't lose with the truth of the Holy Spirit. When you work with us, you're helping to uncover the love, which is Spirit, that exists in everyone's mind. There's a corollary between love and the kingdom of heaven you should think about. Answer this question honestly. What is the most real thing you have in your life? What means the most to you? And Gary says, well, the most real thing I have in my life is my experience, and the most real experience I have is love. Arden, yes. And isn't it interesting that the most real thing you have in your life is something that's invisible, something you can't see? You can't see love. Yes, you can see love in action, but you can't see love. Now, can you see the kingdom of heaven? No, it can't be seen with the body's eyes. Yes, you can see symbols of it briefly, but you can't see the kingdom. Isn't it in the most real thing you can have in your awareness is something you can't see? Do the work to remove the blinders that prevent you from seeing that which cannot be seen. As you know, the kingdom of heaven can be experienced, and it's this experience that gives you a glimpse of the truth you can never forget, making it impossible for you to ever fully believe in the ego again. Do you want to go on from there?
Sure. I was just... since that last comment's about the cow, the urine turning into ammonia. I was looking because I remember learning when I was younger about the sacred things that are done with cows that don't have anything to do with eating their meat. But it's all about, like, the dung can be used for all these different things, the milk, the butter, the ghee, the urine to make ammonia and ammonia nitrate, which becomes a fertilizer. There's all sorts of things that you can get from a cow without killing a cow. And so, you know, people that talk about, you know, the sacred cow being, you know, you don't want to kill it because, you know, it's a god or something. Really, no, cows are much more useful when they're alive. Once they're dead, that's the end of their usefulness. You can make leather out of their hides and, you know, use the bones for things or whatever. But in general, you know, a living cow, just like a living chicken, is much more helpful to you by giving you eggs every day rather than, you know, eating it one day and being hungry the next. So, anyway.
So since you mentioned ghee, right, which is the clarified butter, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that there's this spiritual teacher that's very popular who's got a new line of that clarified butter made out of marijuana, and it's called ganja ghee.
Oh, that's
and I don't think it hits the market. It's hit the market yet, but it should be coming along anytime.
That.
What's that?
Gangaji might not like that.
I play with words. What could I say?
That's very cute, though. All right. What was the last? I'm sorry. I lost my page now.
Okay. I think it was first about to talk about Helen Schuckman.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
I moved back. Okay. So when Helen Schuckman met Ken Wapnick for the first time, she had already been told by Bill Thetford that Ken was a very interesting man. She gave Ken two sections from the text of the course to read. After reading them, Ken knew the course would be his life's work. He had intended to live in a monastery, but just reading two sections of the course changed his life. The two sections were "For They Have Come," which contains a lot of lovely metaphor, and "Choose Once Again." Oh, those are great, which really brings the text home. Like the ending of a great symphony, I'm going to recite for you a part of "For They Have Come." Perhaps you'll understand why it meant so much to Ken and why he went on to dedicate his life to the course. And I think, wasn't this Helen's favorite part, I believe?
It might have been, yeah.
I believe it is. I believe, and that's probably why she gave it to him. So Gary says, so this is from the very first part of the course Ken ever read? Persa, yes, it's talking about those who have heard the call to awaken and are redeeming the world within their holy sight, which is us, you, me, all of us here. We are the they that we're talking about, Jesus is talking about. The blood of hatred fades to let the grass grow green again, and let the flowers be all white and sparkling in the summer sun. What was a place of death has now become a living temple in a world of light, because of them, with a capital T. It is their presence, which is you and me and all of us, it is their presence which has lifted holiness again to take its ancient place upon an ancient throne. Because of them have miracles sprung up as grass and flowers on the barren land that hate had scorched and rendered desolate. What hate has wrought have they undone. And now you stand on ground so holy, heaven leans to join with it and make it like itself. The shadow of an ancient hate has gone, and all the blight and withering have passed forever from the land where they have come. What is 100 or 1,000 years to them, or tens of thousands? When they have come, time's purpose is fulfilled. What never was passes to nothingness. When they have come, what hatred claimed is given up to love, and freedom lights up every living thing and lifts it into heaven, where the lights grow ever brighter as each one comes home. The incomplete is made complete again, and heaven's joy has been increased because what is its own has been restored to it. The bloodied earth is cleansed, and the insane have shed their garments of insanity to join them on the ground whereon you stand. No, my God, would I love it if some of those insane garments were being shed right now. They're happening, right? Heaven is grateful for the gift of what has been withheld so long, for they have come to gather in their own. What has been locked is opened. What was held apart from light is given up, that light may shine on it and leave no space nor distance lingering between the light of heaven and the world. The holiest of all spots on earth is where an ancient hatred has become a present love. And they come quickly to the living temple, where a home for them has been set up. There is no place in heaven holier. And they have come to dwell within the temple offered them to be their resting place as well as yours. What hatred has released to love becomes the brightest light in heaven's radiance, and all the lights in heaven brighter grow in gratitude for what has been restored. Wow.
Pretty nice, huh?
Yeah. Pretty nice. And wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's pretty difficult to not feel the impact of those words and because that really is, you know, it's our calling. It's our awareness that brought us to this search, to go beyond searching, to find, to truly find, to seek and find the truth within ourselves, and to see it within everyone that we meet. And that's, you know, I'm sort of trying to generalize here, but I think everyone listening to this is probably here because we all felt that calling and that longing to return to that place we never left. So.
Yes, and to be grateful for them. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, grateful to yourself for taking up that call and for listening, even as little as we seem to do, and grateful to Gary for, you know, letting this happen. And, you know, I don't know where I'd be without this. Yeah.
Oh, I feel profound gratitude to Gary and his teachers because I had pretty much I hadn't abandoned the course, but I set it down for a number of years and you just pick it up occasionally and thumb through it kind of thing, because I kind of had really hadn't exhausted, you know, what my resources were, but I was off doing other things. But I think I had to reach the point in my life where I recognized that all of those other, you know, spiritual buffet line approaches weren't working. And it just, at just the right time, in the back room of the, Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library, RVML in Ashland, Oregon, there was this book, The Disappearance of the Universe, and I checked it out of the library and it's like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. And, that was after I had discovered it on a friend's coffee table while house sitting, and just had just happened to have seen him among other so-called living luminaries, Marian Williamson, Don Miguel Ruiz, who I got to interview on community radio, and Neil Donald Walsh, you know, a few of those kind of folks that were in this documentary called Living Luminaries, and the only one I wasn't familiar with was Gary Renard. And here was his book sitting on this coffee table of this house where I was house sitting for a week and or so. And I was like, I think I could pick this up and see what's in it. And she actually had both of his first two books there, but I started with Disappearance, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is, I need to get back to this. How did I set this down for so long? And then, well, I wasn't ready, you know, I was unripe. And I'm sure looking back in a few years, I'll look back to where I'm at now and say, wow, I was so divided. Now I'm, you know, more solidly trusting. So,
you know, it's funny because when you think about the people that came to the course through reading that book, mm-hmm. and you recognize the kind of character that Gary is and the kind of, you know, his sense of humor, his goofiness, you know, all this stuff about Gary that is just like so not what you would expect of a great spiritual teacher.
Really?
Well, yeah, you know. I'm saying that only because I mean
that about all of us, you know, because if you look at the form, we're all a motley bunch, you know.
And that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you wouldn't have picked up that book
and
resonated with it if it had been, you know, if it had been written any other way or by any other person or had any other characteristics. You know, we look at that and you know, it's like it was just the right time, and we were just ripening up to the point where we could look at this profound Course in Miracles, even though we were, you know, intellectually and emotionally teenagers, we're just out there trying to to play King of the Hill or whatever, and yeah, we picked up this book, and you know, in spite of all the, you know, this is not a Gurdjieff, or this is not a you know, who else, you know, great spiritual writer. This is not any of that. This is like straight talk of people in the common vernacular that is bringing some clarity to this thing that seems so mysterious. And that was, to me, the Course in Miracles seems so mysterious. And, you know, after I read The Disappearance of the Universe, which, you know, someone at my work had told me about, who wasn't even into A Course in Miracles. They just said, have you read this? And people are saying it's really cool. And I went and got it, and it changed my life completely.
Yeah, so, likewise.
It's like, you know, I would not have been ready for that.
Yeah, and I was into the course in the mid-80s, but I just had, you know, kind of mostly set it aside for a while, and it was like that hurled me back into it in such a wonderful way. A few moments ago, you mentioned Gurdjieff. And I think another little-known fact that I think his first name was actually Henry, and so his nickname actually was Hank Gurdjieff. So,
oh, my God, you just – I love you. You crack me up. And, yeah, Iris has said Don Miguel Ruiz.
That's the other one I was trying to think of. Yeah, Don Miguel is the one I got to interview on community radio and on that – Living Luminaries. He was a delight to meet. A very, very kind-hearted, loving person. And my limited experience with him was very, very positive. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Gurdjieff, I actually took a graduate seminar from Charlie Tart in Gurdjieff, who I learned years later, was studying A Course in Miracles, which is probably why I was drawn to his teaching at UC Davis. Yeah. And then he's been a lifelong friend of, D. Patrick Miller, who published Gary's book. So it's all interconnected, isn't it? I mean.
It is all interconnected. And we're all, I mean, it's almost amazing when you think about it, because, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, take any kind of great specialness here, but early followers of Christianity, for instance, you know, they didn't have they didn't have the internet, they didn't have, you know, the availability of the books, they didn't have the availability of anything really to communicate and share and to know, to share the truth of their teaching, and so Christianity kind of fell into you know, some disrespect or disrepair after a while, even though it's, well, you know, loved throughout the world, but still it's, the religion itself is just hideous. You know, it sends young men out to try to convert, you know, natives who are happily living their own life with God. You know, I mean, but, you know, just think, we're like those very first people who knew, are just a second generation from knowing Jesus. I mean, in my lifetime, you know, I could have known Helen. You know, in my lifetime, I could have, you know, hung out with, you know, and in my lifetime, I am hanging out with, you know, Bob Rosenthal and Judy Scutch and Ken Wapnick and John Mundy and Dove Fishman. And, you know, I mean, we are so blessed and so lucky.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, it really is a blessing. It occurs to me, since we're running over into the next segment, that maybe we should save the last two pages for next week.
Sounds like a good idea.
Okay.
All right. I'm looking at the time, just chattering away. But yeah, I do. I am so very grateful. I'm grateful for you, Bruce.
Oh, so mutual. So mutual, yes.
I mean, God, you know, Gary brought us together. I would never have on you. And, you know, I mean, it really is an awakening that I can, it's palpable. I can feel it. And as we bring more and more and more brothers together, in, you know, however way we do it, global online conferences or in-person conferences or whatever, the more we come together, the happier we'll be.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh. All right.
Back to where we never left, right?
That's right. All right, thank you so much, Bruce Rollins.
Likewise, Lynn.
See you next week, and we will finish this book.
Sounds
great. What we're going to do next. So.
Exactly. Well, I'm actually tomorrow going to give a little talk at the Unity Church in Newport, Oregon, a very short talk on, I'm going to read from The Journey Home and talk about how forgiveness sets the groundwork for gratitude. So anyway, so if anybody's Newport, Oregon tomorrow, I hope that's where I'll be in the morning.
All right. I love you, brother. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
Bye-bye. See you next week.